Session number 12962, Brigadier David Warren, Reel 1.
Could we please start with the preparations which you personally made for D-Day?
We, as a battalion, when we got back from Italy, we were not earmarked to make an assault landing on the continent. But that was changed when the overall plan was changed. And from that moment onwards, the whole of our training was geared to the landing in Normandy. And perhaps this may have been a mistake, because after the landing, of course, we went into the war like everybody else and had to fight our way across Europe. But nevertheless, that is what we did. And to that end, we prepared ourselves by going to the Combined Training Centre at Inverary in Scotland, where we learned the various techniques of landing from assault craft, and the short sea voyage could be practiced in the lock and so on. I was a company commander, and as far as I was concerned, it seemed to me we wanted a very high standard of physical fitness, which I think we achieved. And in our case, having carried out two assault landings before, one in Sicily and one in Italy, the naval side of it was familiar, and we did know about landing craft and how to travel in them and how to get out and so on. And so we did all that, and in the February of 1944, the battalion with the rest of the 50th Division in which we were placed came down to the New Forest. And from that time onwards, until we were prepared to embark for D-Day, we were living in a camp in the woods near Bewley, where we carried out regular training and prepared ourselves for the actual embarkation and short sea voyage by two exercises, which involved going through the full embarkation procedure at Southampton, and then on the ship we were going to travel over the channel, we sailed round the Isle of Wight at night and ended up in the morning in Studland Bay, where we had a simulated area which was purported to be similar to the defenses that we would encounter on the other side of the channel. So we did two of those, and in fact a third one we did, which involved the whole of the embarkation procedure, because to embark a division of men or more in Southampton with the German air threat of air raids was quite a business, and we had to get that straight so it could be carried out very quickly and without any shuffling about. In fact, the first rehearsal we did of the embarkation turned out to be a muddle, I remember, that this particular ship didn't seem to know the rules of embarkation for amphibious warfare, and tried to put us on by units. And of course, you have to go on by serials, that is, by landing craft loads. And so having gone on board for that in the wrong place, as soon as we were out at sea, we had to reshuffle the whole of the ship to get everybody into their serials so they could be called forward on the tannoy system, serial whatever, go to their boats now, and you have to find the route to do it and so on in the rehearsal, so when you come to do it on the day, everything should be as smooth as possible. And I think that is about all I can remember about preparing for D-Day, and I think we were slightly perhaps influenced by the fact that we had done two assault landings before in the Mediterranean.
Which was your company?
C Company.
And how confident did you feel as the training went on that the landings would be successful?
Well, I think we felt very confident that having done it twice, that we could do it the third time. But I think we were all rather prepared for things not to be as simple as we would have hoped to have been, because we had come through it twice reasonably well, and the third time one always feels something might go wrong. But what we all felt, and this was the most astonishing thing I think about the Overlord operation, the Normandy landing, is that everyone was 100% confident that whatever happened to me or to anyone else, or perhaps to the Hampshires, that it would be successful. There was no question of thinking that it might not be, that it was going to be successful. And I think everybody was quite glad to get on with it, because it did. It was like the sort of green light for the end of the war, so it seemed at the time. And so we were very confident, I think.
Now, can you take me through in as much detail as you can recollect what happened to you actually on the 5th and 6th of June?
On the 5th of June, we were anchored on our landing ship infantry in the Solent. The whole of Force G of the Royal Navy, which was transporting the 50th Division, was embarked, and on their ships anchored in the Solent. And, of course, we thought the landing was going to be on the 5th. In fact, we were told it was to be D-Day. But then they postponed it, and it was postponed till the next day. And we were on this landing ship, rather cramped, and rather apprehensive, I think, where we had to read or rehearse the plans for the landing yet once again to make sure that everybody knew them. Because we had had the advantage of having marvelous models of the part of the coast where we were going to land. And so before we ever got on board the ship, we were able to brief everybody from the model, which they were very good indeed. They had all the information, all the intelligence about the enemy, their positions, and anything else which would be relevant was on the model. Of course, we had marked maps as well. And so we spent the day, I think, doing a bit of revision on the plans for the landing, and a little light reading. There was no drink on board, so we didn't have that facility. And really, I think everybody wanted to get on with it. There was no way that we could see anyway to get off the ship, because as we all knew exactly where we were going to land, it would be impossible to keep it as a secret. The security would have gone. So that was what we thought, that we'd have to stay on board. And we did know that you had to catch a certain state of the tide, and the days that it could be that the landing could be carried out were strictly limited.
Perhaps we should go back at this stage to talk about the security arrangements before you set off.
Yes, of course. Looking back on it now, security was the name of the game for that operation, because there were so many people taking part in it, so many people that had to know eventually where the landing was going to be, that it always seemed to me to be an incredible situation that we were able to keep it from the Germans. Because if they had got to know, it would have been a very different story, I suspect, on the landing. And to that end, in our camp in the New Forest, on a certain day before we embarked, about a week before we embarked, I recollect, we were sealed in the camp. No one was allowed outside. The only people who could go outside, when they went into Lyndhurst to get the pay on, I think, Thursday or Friday or whatever, they could go out. They were carefully checked in and out. And I remember one particular party that went for the pay. They were having a little walk in Lyndhurst, and there was a bookshop selling books and maps. And there they saw a map of Normandy right in the window. And of course, this caused quite a stir with everybody. Because I think everyone felt rather edgy about the fact that if the Germans did get to know, we were in for a really rough house. And so that was that. There's another story perhaps I might tell about that security. A brigade commander told me later, after the war, that he remembered going up to London to be briefed with all the other brigade commanders about the plan for the landing. And his wife had a flat up there where he was staying. And when he got home in the evening, his wife said to me, or said to him rather, that she would like him to tell her where it was going to be. She might be able to give him some information. She said, as a matter of fact, we always spent our holidays at Annel, which was near Arromanches, which is exactly where we were intended to land. And he said it was very difficult for me to keep a straight face and say, oh, I think that would be of any use at all. Of course, he couldn't tell her. But he was simply longing to ask her one or two things about the area where we were going to land, but he could not do so. And that's about all, I think, on the security side that I can remember.
So if we can go back to the crossing itself now, please.
The crossing itself. Well, the crossing itself, I think we up anchored at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the Solent. And we sailed out past the Needles in not a bad evening, not too rough, and good visibility. And you could see other ships moving in the same direction as us. And we could see the minesweepers, which led the convoy ahead. And I remember standing on deck and admiring the scenery, really. It seemed unrealistic that we were going to go to war in the morning. And we got to bed fairly early. As we were, I think we got up at about 3 in the morning to get ready. And had a restless night, I think. We were in rather cramped accommodation, I remember. That it was difficult to get to sleep. One was a bit apprehensive. We hadn't got into the rhythm of war. We'd all been in that before. And once you get into it, you can sleep quite easily. In fact, you can sleep very easily because you're always very tired. But we weren't really all that tired. And I remember not really sleeping very well and going over in my mind again and again the various things I had to remember tomorrow. And so we went on through the night. I think the ship was rolling, one might say, gently. And one was conscious, of course, that the German E-boats and various other ships they had might be able to get into the convoy and start firing off a few torpedoes, but that didn't happen. And in the morning, we were called up on the tannoy for reveille to get up. And we got up, and the ship had arranged for us to have a very good breakfast indeed. I mean, probably the best they could produce. And we had that. And then it was time to get down to the troop decks to join your serial for the embarkation. And I remember going down there and checking through the equipment and the stuff we had to carry up and put in the LCA, that's the landing craft that we used. we had put some of the heavier stuff in the landing craft on the previous day. We carried, I think, some Bangalore torpedoes, which were rather heavy, for blowing our way through the wire. And people were curiously quiet, really, I think, that morning. Of course, they, people are quieted at 5 o'clock in the morning, but they were. And when we were called forward, it was all quite orderly. But the sea was distinctly rougher, and it was a rather grey morning. And I suppose we got into the landing craft about 5:30, because we had to get the landing craft lowered into the sea, and then we'd circle about while we formed up in our flotillas. And it was just about first light, and soon after first light, suddenly this enormous armada of naval ships and so on opened fire with a terrific noise. I think we passed the cruiser, HMS Ajax, a 6-inch gun cruiser, and she let go just as we were near her. It was a terrific noise, very heartening if you were getting this the same way. And we bumped around in the landing craft while we formed up for the run in. And I recollect that we'd had tea and rum put in for people to drink going in, but a lot of people were feeling seasick, and I think tea and rum was not the best thing for a person who was seasick. Fortunately, I don't suffer from it, but we had to cope with it. And apart from it, our equipment that we were wearing, of course, we had these May Wests, which were blown up and supposed to keep us afloat if we got hit and had to go into the sea. So we had the run in the rather grey light of the morning, and a very noisy morning too. And it was very impressive, the number of ships that were formed up off the Normandy coast. It was terrific. I've never seen anything like it before. And the next horror really was that we knew a great deal about the beach on which we were going to land. We'd had all sorts of air photographs taken. So we knew what it was like, and we'd had the model. But going in, I suddenly realized that with the bombardment, there was such a lot of dust and some fires and smoke and that sort of thing, that it was difficult to see where we exactly wanted to land. We knew exactly where we wanted to land, but to pick it out was difficult. And we went on, and we finally drew very near the beach. And I remember what happened to my landing craft. It bumped into a thing called a runnel, which is a sandbank, a small sandbank. And the doors opened in the front, and we were being shot at, and there was the odd bit of mortar fire. And stepping out, you suddenly stepped into the water, which came right up to your chest. And very cold water that morning. So we had to struggle through this. And although we didn't have any casualties from drowning on my landing craft, they did occur with shorter men, because we were carrying a great deal in terms of ammunition, mortar bombs, small arms ammunition and so on, far more than we would in a normal battle. And anyway, I went in up to my chest. And one of the great things that's always impressed upon you about an amphibious landing is get up the beach as fast as you can, get away from the landing craft. And that is what, of course, one did. But I could see the beach, and there was the odd specialist tank stuck on the beach. I think there was one on fire, and presumably the others had been knocked out, who had been sent in ahead, and their job was to make gaps through the mines and the wire at the top of the beach. Now, one of the difficulties that we had, we expected to find a gap on the beach to go through, but we did not find it, because it wasn't there. They hadn't been able to get up the beach. This particular beach was enfiladed, that is, there was a German position at the end of it, and they could rake the whole of the beach with fire. And also there was a gun, which appeared to be some form of anti-tank gun. And that, of course, was in concrete and steel. This position at Le Hamel, where we landed, was to cause us a great deal of trouble. And it had excellent fields of fire. And the Germans, in fact, did not show much sign of giving up. So when we got up the beach, I realized that we should have to gap our way through ourselves, cut our way through the mines and the wire. There are various drills that you have to do that. And we started to do that. Meanwhile, the casualties were piling up because the fire was very strong from the Germans, and it was raking along the top of the beach where people were trying to get. So I think we got quite a few casualties there. And it was while we were trying to gap our way off the beach that I saw, limping rather badly, the commanding officer, Colonel Nelson Smith. And he had been hit by a piece of mortar bomb as he got out of his landing craft. And he obviously wasn't going to go very far, but he managed to get as far as that. And it was there that he told me to take over, as he would have to give up. And I think he actually got back on the same landing craft that brought him in. So I was suddenly faced with this problem of coping with a very difficult situation, because we wanted to get off the beach, and our plan was rather geared to getting off the beach and getting round to the back of things. The radios we had then, although some worked satisfactorily, some didn't, but I could find out enough to know that the position overlooking Arromanche, which was about a couple of miles east along the coast, the company that had been directed on a clifftop near there was doing very well. That was getting on. But I learned that that A company, that's about a company, it's about 100, well, it was on the operation, about 120 men. They should have landed right on top of this position at Le Hamel. And they would have scaled up the sea wall and silenced it, or should have done. In fact, they didn't, and there were very heavy casualties, and they really ceased to exist as a company. So we incorporated all the people we could find who were okay, and as it were, told them to join a C company. And I decided that we must deal with this position overlooking Le Hamel. By this time, we've been able to gap our way off the beach, and we got over the mines and so on. And there I met a tank which was called an Avery. It was a Royal Engineer assault tank, specially equipped. And this particular one had a mortar-like gun on it called a petard, which fired a large bomb. So I spoke to the commander of the tank, and I told him that I wanted him to support this attack on Le Hamel. And the tank came forward, and it was a hospital, an old hospital actually. It fired the bomb onto the buildings that had been reinforced and so on. And when he did that, we assaulted it and went inside, and it was silenced. And that was a great relief to all concerned, because there was a lot of landing craft which were having difficulties on our beach. They could then come ashore, the beach masters, could get things organized rather better. Meanwhile, the fighting was going on just east of Arromanches, and also at the back of Le Hamel. There were odd Germans everywhere. They were completely disillusioned, I think. As a matter of fact, at Le Hamel West, the other end of the village, there was a position which we had to capture. And when we got there, the Germans put up no fight at all. They came out with their hands up. Of course, overhead, I mean, there was a lot of aircraft. There was our aircraft. I can't remember seeing a German aircraft in the whole of the landing. There may have been one, but I don't recollect it now. But there were a lot of aeroplanes. And it's interesting to note that in this tremendous fire plan that had been laid on for the landing on various positions on the beaches, this position that causes all the trouble at Le Hamel East, it was due to receive the bombs of 200 flying fortresses. Now, obviously, that didn't happen, but we found out later that the bombs had all landed about 700 or 800 yards inland. They hadn't hit Le Hamel East, but nevertheless, it had been given a pretty good pasting. It took 2,000 rockets. They had landing craft fitted up with rockets, and these were poured into Le Hamel East. But the strength of the German defenses, the concrete and the steel, was such that they didn't really make any great impact. We continued on with the battle, and once the position east of Arromanches was secured, I remember going up there, I decided that we'd better get into Arromanches. That was very important because, as we all now know, the Mulberry was going to be built there. And so we went into Arromanches. It was quite extraordinary. There wasn't a sign of anyone there. All the civilians, presumably, had taken to the cellars and so on, but there was no resistance in the town at all. So we secured that. And by this time passed incredibly quickly. It was somewhere near 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. And so I arranged to secure Arromanches from a counterattack and to keep an eye out for the Americans who were supposed to link up with us from their beaches further west. In fact, we never saw them. We failed to connect with them. We didn't connect with them for about 2 days. And we got back. And it seemed to me that we were as secure as we could be. And I established the battalion headquarters in Le Hamel, in some outbuildings of a farm. By this time it was dark.